Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the fossil record when we come back. You know, in Job 38, verse 24, we read a scientific question. It says, by what way is it that the light is parted? Or paraphrased, it would say, by what way or technique is the light apportioned or separated? Now imagine asking that question 4,000 years ago. Today, of course, it's a simple question to ask and answer. The student instantly says, well, by passing it through the prism of the spectroscope. But who could have known anything about a spectroscope 4,000 years ago in Job's day? And since it's manifestly impossible for any human mind to frame a question that the mind knows nothing of, we're dealing with a greater mind than the mind of Job in this case. But when we heat a metal red hot, or if we heat any substance until it's incandescent, it gives forth rays of light. These rays, after passing through the spectroscope, divide themselves on a graph according to the content of the matter that sent them forth. So when a ray of light reaches us from some far-flung star, we need only to pass that light ray through the spectroscope to see the composition of the star and the proportion of each of its ingredients. And this division of the light rays is always constant, and it doesn't vary in the least particular, so that we can always rely upon the results. Now, spectroscopic analysis is an exact science, and this is the manner by which the light is apportioned or separated. Now, this places us in a quandary, because either Job knew this, or we're dealing with a supernatural wisdom that's being revealed here. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Bible. And it's one more of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School that we teach here in Isabella, Missouri at the law school. So for more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, last time we took a look at the universe, let's take a look at the fossil record. The fossil record, fossils, you know, those thingies that you dig up out of the ground. Down here in Isabella, Missouri, every once in a while, we'll be walking down the creek, and my wife, she'll be looking at these various rocks, you know, and she'll say, oh, look at this. And then she'll pick up a rock, and there'll be an imprint of a fern in this rock, or an imprint of a clam shell or something like that. Sometimes you'll find one, you know, that's got a clam shell sticking out of it, fossilized. Very common. You find them all over the world. They're everywhere. And they're about as common as pig tracks in a barnyard. Now, this fossil record over here has a story to tell. I guess it depends upon how you look at the story as to what it tells you. But fossils are the remains of ancient forms of life preserved in the Earth's crust. And these may be skeletons or parts of skeletons, such as bones, teeth, or shells. Now, a fossil also may be some trace of the activity of what once was alive, such as the imprint or trail, a footprint or something like that. Many fossils no longer contain their original material, but are made up of mineral deposits that have infiltrated them and have taken on their shape. Now, why are fossils important to evolution? Well, geneticist G.L. Stibbins noted a major reason. He said, no biologist has actually seen the origin by evolution of a major group of organisms. We've never been able to observe evolution in operation. So living things on Earth today are not seen to be evolving into something else. Instead, they're all complete in form, and they're very distinct from any other type. As geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky, that's a name for you, observe, he said, the living world is not a single array connected by unbroken series of intergrades. And Charles Darwin conceded that the distinctness of specific living forms and their not being blended together by innumerable transitional links is a very obvious difficulty. Let me pause here and make my famous editorial comment. There are no intermediate links. None. Zero. All right? Did you hear that? Now, there's been a lot of lies and a lot of fabrications, like embryos and about the horse. You know, they'll take a little animal over here, and they take the bones of these animals, and they stretch it out, and pretty soon you got this horse stint over here. That's a hoax. It's a lie. It was uncovered as being a hoax. It's unscientific. It ain't true. And then remember when we went to school, and they showed us all of these embryos, and they said, well, all of these embryos, you know, when they start out, they all look alike.
That was first discovered to be a hoax back in 1874. I mean, that wasn't something that was discovered in 1996 when Bill Clinton was running for president. Hell, that was discovered to be a hoax. It's like Piltdown Man. I mean, they don't print Piltdown Man in the textbooks anymore. They took that one out. But there have been literally dozens of these lying hoaxes. And some of them, which are lying hoaxes that have been discovered to be lies 100 years ago or 130 or 40 years ago, are still in the textbooks to this day. We're still lying to our children, which isn't surprising. Hell, we still lie to them about Christmas, Easter, New Year's, don't we? I guess maybe it's the penalty that we deserve for being liars and lying to our children. We're lied to and we believe the lies that we're being told. It's kind of like Iraq. You know, we believe the crap that comes out of Washington because Tony Snow told us. If the president's news agent, his spin doctor, tells us something, I guess we're all supposed to believe that. Now, if evolution were a fact, you know, if it were a fact, the difficulty or the distinct varieties of things that are now alive offer no support to the theory of evolution, and that is why the fossil record became so important. It was felt that at least fossils would provide the confirmation that the theory of evolution needed to prove that it was true. So since we can't see evolution going on, we can't take it into the test yet, we can't take it into the laboratory, we can't observe it anywhere, it doesn't happen, so now we come along and we say, well, it must be in the fossil record. Well, we've been looking on the fossil record now for 150 years and we haven't found it there either. Now, you know, if you're looking for something as hard as evolutionists have been looking for fossils and missing links for 150 years, you know, you'd think we'd find one or two. Haven't found even one. We should have been able to find hundreds by now, maybe thousands, but we haven't found a single one. And yet we're still writing in our textbooks and lying and deceiving our children, lying and deceiving ourselves again. Now, if evolution were a fact, the fossil evidence would surely reveal a gradual changing from one kind of life into another, and that would have to be the case, regardless of which variation of evolutionary theory you want to accept. Even scientists who believe in the more rapid changes associated with punctuated equilibrium acknowledge that there would still have to have been many thousands of years during which these changes supposedly took place. It's not reasonable to believe that there would be no need at all for linking fossils. And also, if evolution were founded in fact rather than fantasy, the fossil record would be expected to reveal beginnings of new structures in living things. There should be at least some fossils with developing arms and developing legs. We should see some fossils with some half fins or quarter fins or three-quarter fins, some wings and eyes and other bones and organs that aren't fully developed yet. For instance, there should be fish fins changing into amphibian legs with feet and toes and gills changing into lungs. There should be reptiles with front limbs changing into bird wings, back limbs changing into legs with claws, scales clinging into or changing into feathers, and mouths changing into horny beaks. In this regard, the British journal New Scientist says of the theory, it predicts that a complete fossil record would consist of lineages of organisms showing gradual change continuously over long periods of time. And as Darwin himself asserted, the number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed must be truly enormous. In fact, boys and girls, if you'll think about it for a minute, there have to be more intermediate species than final products. More intermediate species than final products. Now, have you ever thought about fossils and how they're formed? Well, fossils are formed by catastrophism. You see, evolution is predicated upon uniformitarianism. And here's the difference, you know, for a couple of you out there, maybe I haven't heard this before. A guy by the name of Charles Lyell, back in 1831, he wrote a book. And in his book, he said, what we're seeing today is what's been going on forever. And when you see the Colorado River running through the Grand Canyon, that's what made that canyon. That river made that canyon. Now, we all would admit that the canyon is there. I mean, if you've ever been there and looked at the Grand Canyon or seen a picture of it, there it is. It's a big hole in the ground. And there's a river running through the bottom of it. That river's been running through there for a long time. We don't know how long, but it's been there for a long time. So we look at that and we say to ourselves, well, how did that thing get here? Well, Charles Lyell says, well, that river running through the canyon is wearing it down at the rate of about 1 inch per century. That's the number I've seen. I don't know how they measured that, but I'm going to give it to them. After all, that's their story. They said it wears it down 1 inch per century. Well, the bottom of the canyon from the top of the canyon is 5,400 feet. So, I mean, you just take 5,400 feet, you know, 5,400, use my famous Sharpie L1197 here. You have 5,400 feet. Well, how many inches are there in 5,400 feet? And so we take 5,400 times 12, and that's 64,800 times 100 years. That equals 6,480,000 years to dig that canyon up. That's what Charles Lyell says. Now, the Bible comes along and says in Genesis 6, 7, 8, 9 that there was a big flood came along and washed that canyon out in about 3 hours, which is what we saw at Mount St. Helens when the Tuttle River was blocked up by mud and debris. And when the river got up behind those landslides, it just washed them out, and there was a giant flood. And today, there's the Tuttle River running down through all of that mess. I mean, we can see what floods do today. We haven't seen a flood the size of the Grand Canyon, but we've seen other floods, and we see what happens when a river gets dammed up and then it washes it out. I mean, that's about as common as pig tracks. We've got pictures, and I've seen many movie pictures of those kinds of floods and those kinds of debris blocking events. That's what happened at the Grand Canyon, and it all washed out in about 3 hours. Well, maybe it took 3 days, but it didn't take 6.5 million years to wear that canyon down. Now, when you take a look here at these fossils and the fossil record, we see fossils everywhere. We see fossils at the bottom of the Grand Canyon and on top of the Grand Canyon. And we see lots of strata in between. And they tell us that millions and millions and billions of years have gone by for these events to transpire. And so, I've mentioned this a time or two, so I'm going to mention it to you right now concerning the sun. Now, we all see the sun up there. The sun is shrinking. Did you know that? In fact, we've been watching the sun now for a couple hundred years, 300 years, as a matter of fact. In fact, it's the English that have been doing this, and they've been watching it for 300 years over in Greenwich, England. And the people have lived and died, and that's all they did all their lives, just watch the sun and measure it and observe it and one thing, and it's been going on for a long time. Well, listen to this. The sun is shrinking, and it's a Newswire report that occurred back in 1980, and they made this surprising statement. The sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century. And scientists have been watching for over 100 years, and the evidence is now conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking by about 5 feet. Now, if the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, then it totals 1% per millennium. And if the sun existed 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter. 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth. And as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent since the origin of the sun. All right, there's an example. Uniformitarianism. What you see going on today has been going on for billions and billions of years. That's preposterous poppycock. I mean, that's a lie that, hell, even a plumber can uncover. Now, let's think about this for a second, all you fellow plumbers out there. Remember when we went to high school, and you opened your textbook, and they said the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago. Do you remember that? That's the number. Just pick up the textbook, 65 million years ago. The dinosaurs died out. Truth of the matter is, the dinosaurs were on the ark with Noah. They lived after the ark. They called them dragons. And there are traditions in China and all over the world from people from that day to this that talk about George the Dragon Killer. Today, of course, we call them dinosaurs. The Bible doesn't call them dinosaurs. It calls it Leviathan and Behemoth. And it describes them as having tails the size of cedar trees. Animals today don't have large tails, they have small tails. So when you have a big animal like an elephant, he has a little tiny tail. You take a look at a dinosaur, he has a great big tail in proportion to his body size. So the Bible talks about dinosaurs. It doesn't call them dinosaurs, but then, you know, just because we call them dinosaurs doesn't mean the Bible's incorrect. The Bible called them Leviathans and Behemoths. But anyway, the moral of the story is looking at the record here, the fossil record, they go back and they say, well, these dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago. Now, another group of scientists, they're over here watching the sun, and they say, okay, now the sun is shrinking by about 5 feet in an hour. And I want to sit here, every hour the sun is shrinking 5 feet. Well, the sun today is about 750,000 miles in diameter. So if you measured out the diameter of the sun, 750,000. So you go back here and you just start doing the arithmetic, and 20 million years ago, the sun would be 93 million miles in diameter. Well, the Earth is circling around the sun today, 93 million miles from the sun. Lyell and the uniformitarians and the evolutionists say this has been going on this way forever. For billions and billions of years. Horse pucky! It hasn't been going on for billions and billions of years. It couldn't have been going on for longer than 20 million years. And therefore, the numbers on the dinosaurs is as phony as a $3 Federal Reserve note. Not that a $5 Federal Reserve note's any better, but at least we know a $3 bill is phony, don't we? Even if we believe the fives are good. Now, that's just one. I could sit here and spin out these stories about, you know, the Niagara Falls, you know, and the sun. Hell, the arithmetic doesn't even add up. Now, many of us believe in evolution, and we go to college and we get letters after our names, and nobody's ever sat down and ever said, well, geez, let's get our Sharp EL1197G out here and let's do the arithmetic. This is what they're telling us. Now, let's see how this checks out. I guess we just believe it like Santa Claus. I believed in Santa Claus. We had an oil-burning heat source, you know, we had an oil stove, and had a 6-inch chimney went up there, and we went down to Brizard's store, and I heard the story about Santa Claus coming down the chimney. Now, the problem that I devolved here after I got this Christmas thing, I got to thinking about poor old Santa Claus, because we had a fire going in the heater, wintertime. December 25th is the wintertime. This is when we have a fire going in the oil-burning stove. Isn't Santa Claus going to get burned up when he comes down the chimney? I don't know what my granny said. I remember asking the question. I don't remember what her answer was now, but I'm sure she came up with a good lie that a five-year-old kid would believe. I believed it. But, you know, then I got to be six and then seven and eight, you know. By the time I got to be 16 years old, I didn't believe in this Santa Claus crap anymore. You know, it took me a while, but, you know, I was born at night, but not last night, for crying out loud. Let's grow up and be intelligent people. Now, this fossil record over here, we're being told over here, it's got all of these missing links in it. And the evolutionists, guys like Charlie Darwin, you know, and Lyell, and all these guys, they all readily admit that, yeah, there's got to be these missing links. Now, we've been looking for 150 years, and there's no missing links. We've got museums now full of fossils without any missing links. It isn't that we're short a missing link. There aren't any. Zero. Zilch. They don't exist. That's what our problem is. Now, I'm not here to tell you to believe in Jesus and get yourself saved and go to heaven. You know, your religion, you know, is your thing in life. Well, my point is here is that this fossil record over here is a damn lie. And Carl Sagan and this Charlie Lyell and Darwin, these guys have been lying to us. Now, part of it is that those guys didn't know. They didn't know any better. But today we do. You could say that, well, Charles Lyell didn't know. And Charles Darwin, he didn't know because they were early on in the theory. But, you know, 150 years later, the theory didn't pan out, and we're still printing the crap in our textbooks and teaching that to our kids. Now, Santa Claus does not come down the chimney, and missing links do not exist in the fossil record. Well, that's the bottom line. Now, if you want to believe in evolution, hell, don't be my guest. I don't care. My point is I'm a reporter, and I'm going to expose the lies. You can believe what you want to. It's your choice in life. Now, however, is the fossil record complete enough for a fair test of whether it's creation or evolution that finds support? Well, over a century ago, Darwin did not think so. What was wrong with the fossil record in Darwin's time? Well, it didn't contain the transitional links required to support his theory. This situation caused him to say, why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this perhaps is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory. The fossil record in Darwin's day proved disappointing to him in another way. He explained it this way. He said, the abrupt manner in which whole groups of species suddenly appear in certain formations has been urged by several paleontologists as a fatal objection to the belief in the transmutation of the species. And he added, there's another and allied difficulty, which is much more serious. I allude to the manner in which species belonging to several of the main divisions of the animal kingdom suddenly appear in the lowest known fossiliferous rocks. The case at present must remain inexplicable and may be truly urged as a valid argument against the evolutionary views here entertained. Darwin attempted to explain these huge problems by attacking the fossil record. He said, I look at the geological record as a history of the world imperfectly kept, imperfect to an extreme degree. It was assumed by Darwin and others that as time passed, the missing fossil link surely would be found. Now, after well over a century of extensive digging, vast numbers of fossils have been unearthed. Is the record still so imperfect? Well, the book called The Processes of Organic Evolution says, the record of past forms of life is now extensive and is constantly increasing in richness as paleontologists find, describe, and compare new fossils. So paleontologists, you know, kids have been out here digging around in the ground for 150 years, and they've dug up thousands and thousands of fossils. Hell, there's fossils. I'm telling you, I can walk down my creek over here and find fossils. You can probably go dig up fossils where you're located. I remember one time on a field trip, we left this high school. It was an ag class. We left the ag shop and we went up in the mountains there toward Petrolia, up on what they call the Wildcat. And we got up there about, I don't know, 2,000 feet elevation, stopped. We were all riding in a big truck, you know. So we all piled out of this big truck, the shop truck. And the instructor took us over to a bank of what looked like sand or clay. And it's just full of seashells. I mean, thousands and thousands of these seashells. And so the ag teacher, he says, well, now this dirt right here was underwater at one time. Well, duh. Yeah, when you see clams at 2,000 feet above sea level, yeah, that makes all the sense in the world. That must have been below water, you know, at some point in time. Well, he went on to explain how the land sinks down into the oceans, and then it rises up over millions of years, and then it sinks down, and then it rises up, and then it sinks down, and it rises up, and that's how all of these strata are laid down. And he says, now it's risen up. Oh. It couldn't be a flood, like Mount St. Helens and the Tuttle River. Couldn't be like Genesis 6 tells us that there was a worldwide flood, and that those are indeed ocean-dwelling clams that have been covered up by silt and then thrust up out of the ocean during this great flood, which is called catastrophism. See, that's the other half of this uniformitarianism. On the one hand, you've got uniformitarianism, which we do not see working. But we see catastrophism, like we see at Mount St. Helens, like we see described in Genesis 6, that we see, but we don't believe what we see, but we believe what we're told and can't see, can't duplicate, and can't prove. You've never seen Santa Claus come down the chimney, but you believe it, and you teach it. You believed it. You've taught it to your children, in spite of the fact that the chimney isn't big enough to accommodate a man, much less being driven around through the sky in a flying machine called a sleigh being pulled by a reindeer. I mean, at least, you know, let's be intelligent and put a rocket on that sleigh. Let's at least be intelligent and put him in an airplane or something to fly him around, you know. Now, life appears suddenly. Now, when we take a look here at life forms, here's what we know. Life forms like dogs have chromosomes. Life forms like human beings have chromosomes. Humans have 48 chromosomes. I saw a fern. Now, fern is kind of a simple life form. 247 chromosomes. I was looking at a chromosome table the other day. All right, so if you take a look at a dog, he's got so many chromosomes, and you take a look at a cat, and it's got so many chromosomes. If the chromosomes aren't the same, they can't interbreed. I mean, it's just that simple. So when the scripture says kind reproduces after kind, dog kinds reproduce after dog kinds. Whether it's a coyote or a wolf or it's a Labrador retriever, it's a dog kind, it's a canine, those can interbreed. They don't interbreed with cats, and they don't interbreed with monkeys. And that's why when we look in the fossil record, we don't see any monkeys devolving into something else and something else and something else. These intermediate species aren't there because there is a boundary line. That's the bottom line. That's what we can observe. That's what we can see. That's what we can duplicate. That's what we can replicate in the laboratory. I mean, that's reality. That's science. That's what science is. It's the replication of it. It's an experiment that we can duplicate over and over again, get the same results. Hey, kids, you can look through that fossil record until hell freezes over and you can't find a single intermediate species. We've been looking for 150 years and ain't found a single one yet, and there should be more intermediate species than final products. I mean, you didn't move from a chimpanzee to a man. You moved from a chimpanzee to a something, that something moved to something, to something, to something, to something, and then to a man. All right, there had to have been a number of intermediate steps over here. And if you've got fossils of men and you got fossils of chimpanzees, and your theory says that the man evolved from or evolved from the chimpanzee, you got more intermediate species than you've got chimpanzees or men. Got lots of men, got lots of chimpanzees, ain't got a single intermediate species, not one. And we've got letters after our names, and we believe this crap. I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. And if you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the webpage as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the fossil record, which comes from a book called Life, How Did It Get Here? By Evolution or by Creation. It's a book put out by the Jehovah's Witnesses. Heck of a good book. I think you'll really enjoy it. I did. I read books all the time, and then I Then I pick them up and I said, gee, would I review this book? And I want to tell you that it's the thing that really impressed me here is that they claim they put out 18,800,000 copies of this. I mean, we're talking about a bestseller here. I don't know if it made the New York Times bestseller list, but they've published or sold or given away 18,800,000 copies, and that was in 1985. 85, for crying out loud. I don't know if the book's still in print or not. We'll give credit where credit's due. It's put out by the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania, International Bible Students Association, all rights reserved. And if you want a copy, I would imagine if you just called the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of New York or Pennsylvania or any place, you know, in your local area, called your local local Jehovah's Witness Church, I'll bet you they'd send out three guys in a van and deliver you a copy free of charge. Now, if you don't want to be inconvenienced by the propaganda that goes along with religious tracts, and this isn't a religious book, it's a well-documented, well-written science textbook, well-footnoted, well-done. In fact, I was amazed. Obviously, the Watchtower people must have gone out and got some creation scientists to put this together. It's 20 chapters. I mean, they've got chapters here, you know, on, well, the one I'm doing here, the fossil record. And well thought out, well done, well researched. And it's written in easy to read language. It's not written in scientific language like the Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris. I mean, when Whitcomb and Morris wrote that book, they must have taken simple, easy words, you know, like them, there, and some, and then looked up in a thesaurus so that they could find five-syllable, double-jointed, knee-action words that nobody's ever heard of in its place so that you could not understand what they were telling you. Now, that's the common way to write a book. You write the thing as incomprehensible as possible so that you can, you know, just bedazzle everybody that reads all of these big words. And, wow, this guy's really smart. Look at these words that none of us can understand. And then I kind of make fun of you and say, well, you know, you're obviously uneducated. I like this book because even as dumb as I am with my IQ down around 80, 85, something like that, hell, I could understand it. And so I appreciate that from the Watchtower people. And so I got to make my quick apology here and tell you I'm not a Jehovah's Witness. And so don't get mad at me now. Write me a letter. Tell everybody that I'm a Jehovah's Witness. That'll be the next thing out on the internet. They'll say, do you know what Gordon believes? He's a Jehovah's Witness. And we know that. And I read Mein Kampf, so I must be a Nazi. On top of that, a Nazi Jehovah's Witness, I guess. All right, now going back here to the fossil record. Let's take a little closer look at the evidence in this book, Red Giants and White Dwarfs, Robert Jastrow states. Sometime in the first billion years, life appeared on the Earth's surface. Slowly, the fossil record indicates, living organisms climbed the ladder from simple to more advanced forms. From this description, one would expect that the fossil record has verified a slow evolution from the first simple life forms to the more complex ones. Yet the same book says, the critical first billion years during which life began are blank pages in the Earth's history. All right. Now remember, we already took a look at this billion number just by looking at the sun. If you're going to have life forms evolving, you got to have the sun out there, don't you? Boys and girls, in 20 million years at 5 feet an hour. Is that what it was, 5 feet an hour or a day? Let me look it up here again for you. Every hour, the sun is shrinking by 5 feet. 5 feet an hour. In 20 million years, boys and girls, the Earth and the sun would be touching each other because the sun would be 93 million miles in diameter. Just do the arithmetic. So the next time you hear billions and billions of years, it's just preposterous poppycock. Well, it's either that or the other scientists who have been studying the sun are a bunch of damn liars, and the sun is not burning up at the rate of 5 feet an hour, which they claim to have been watching for the last 300 years. In which case, well, then we're going to believe the paleontologists, but we're not going to believe the astronomers, because the astronomers are lying or the paleontologists are lying. And I'll take your pick. Who's lying? Whose science is false, because they both can't be true. You can't have the sun being burned up at 5 feet an hour and have billions of years. And that's just nonsense. And anybody that would believe that would believe that Santa Claus comes down a 6-inch pipe into a hot burning oil stove to deliver presents on December the 25th, which is what I believed when I was 4 or 5 years old. Honest to God, I believe Santa Claus was coming down that chimney, down that stovepipe. Going on. Also, can those first types of life truly be described as simple? You know, going back in time to the age of the oldest rocks, says Evolution from Space, fossil residues of ancient life forms discovered in the rocks do not reveal a simple beginning. Although we may care to think of fossil bacteria and fossil algae and microfungi as being simple compared to a dog or a horse, the information standard remains enormously high. Most of the biochemical complexity of life was present already at the time the oldest surface rocks of the Earth were formed. From this beginning, can any evidence at all be found to verify that one-celled organisms evolved into two-celled organisms, and then four-celled organisms, and then many-celled organisms? The fossil record contains no trace of these preliminary stages in the development of many-celled organisms, says Jastrow, and instead he states, the record of the rocks contains very little other than bacteria and one-celled plants until about 1 billion years ago. After some 3 billion years of invisible progress, a major breakthrough occurred. The first many-celled creatures appeared on Earth. Hold it. Here's an evolution. He says the first many-celled creatures appeared on Earth about 1 billion years ago. That guy's a liar. Maybe he doesn't know that, but I do. I know he's a liar because I know that the sun is being consumed at 5 feet an hour. Cut it right here in front of me in another science bulletin. Now, I tell you, kids, we need to think about this a little bit more seriously. Now, you know, if you want to teach your kids that Santa Claus comes down a 6-inch pipe, oh, that's your choice in life. If you want to believe that a cell is simple, that's fine, but that's because you've never seen a cell. I mean, if you ever saw a blown-up picture of a cell and then a cross-section of it with all of the parts that go into a cell, as tiny as it is, cells aren't very big. They're pretty little guys. And you take a look at the complexity of it, and then you tell me that that's simple. That's because you're ignorant and don't know what a cell looks like. There's nothing simple about a cell. Now, somebody told me that a human body, I imagine 170-pound man, that's what they call average, used to be average, 170-pound man contains about 1 trillion cells, a trillion cells in an average man. Now, the cells in our bodies over here are all different. Did you know that? I mean, the cells that are on your knuckle, take a look at the knuckle on your fingers here. Bend your finger in and take a look at that. Did you know that the cells that are on the skin on that knuckle are different than the cells above and below the knuckle? Yeah, they are. They're different. And notice that your knuckles, when you bend your finger, the skin is loose there. Has to be. If it wasn't, your skin would bind up and you couldn't bend your finger. Boy, that was fortuitous that the cells are different on your knuckles so that they all bend and work, and that they're not just all the same skin cells, because then they wouldn't work. Hell, you got to be about 75 or 80, you know, about like me, you know, and your skin's getting kind of loose and baggy, then they might work. But when you're 6 or 8 or 10 or 20 or 30 years old, they wouldn't. Did you know that the cells in your liver are something different than the cells in your heart, and the cells in your heart are something different than the cells in your blood, and the cells in your blood are something different than the cells in your eyes and in your hair? You know, you've probably got 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 different kinds of cells in your body, maybe more, I don't know. Now, it was fortuitous that all those cells evolved differently so that they can all serve different functions in the more complex creature called the man, the ape, or the something else, no doubt about it. Now, it's true that you exist, and I exist, and donkeys exist, and monkeys exist, and the question that we're trying to answer here is, well, how'd they get here? We got two theories. We got one, they were created by an intelligence, and the other is that they just happened by random chance. It just happened by random chance. And so, we're taking a look at that over here, and this random chance thing over here doesn't stand to muster. That's the bottom line. And so then that only leaves special creation. Well, no, I'm not prepared to make that claim. I've discovered in life that there's about 4 ways to do anything. 4 ways to do anything. There's the best way, which is the fastest and the cheapest, and then there's the poorest way, which is the slowest and the most costly. And then there's a couple of 3 in between. All 4 of them work. And they all happen. You know, they all work. And that oftentimes you can have some 3rd, 4th, or 5th solution to a problem that nobody else has thought of. I mean, there could be some 3rd, 4th, or 5th, but I don't know what those might be. I've only heard people come to me and they say, well, I'm a Catholic, and therefore here's what we believe. Well, boys and girls, here in America, there's 476 of these religions, and I'm not here defending Jehovah's Witnesses or Catholics or anybody else. In fact, I'm of the opinion that these religions over here are probably most of our problem rather than a solution. And I've said before, and I'll say it again, that the religious guys over here are the biggest enemies of the Bible. I mean, they just absolutely hate it. Now, evidently, the Jehovah's Witnesses don't hate it quite as much as some others, because they wrote a pretty good book here, a pretty good story, which corroborates Genesis 1, 2, and 3. I don't know if they believe the rest of the Bible, but they at least believe, or at least claim to believe, at least those 3 chapters. Now, these first many-celled creatures appeared on Earth, they tell us, 1 billion years ago. It's a damn lie. Thus, at the start of what is called the Cambrian period, the fossil record takes an unexplained dramatic turn. A great variety of fully developed complex sea creatures, many with hard outer shells, appear so suddenly that this time is often called the explosion of living things. Yeah, when the Great Flood occurred, it buried them first. Boys and girls, clams and oysters and shelled fish are already on the bottom. And when a flood comes and deposits silt over the top of them, which later hardens into rock, they get fossilized first. And that's the Another thing about fossils, these fossils have to be buried and buried suddenly to make fossils. Otherwise, they rot and disappear. Let's try it. Do you know that in the 1800s, there were millions of buffalo here on the Great Plains of America? How many fossil buffalo are being dug up today? Somebody's going to say, well, my God, it takes millions of years to make fossils. Well, okay. And then we had millions and millions of buffalo, so there should be millions and millions of fossils of buffalo in process, shouldn't there? There isn't. None. Zero zilch. Our forefathers went out and shot those buffaloes, and it all rotted away. If you're going to preserve those fossils, they got to be buried. They got to be buried. They got to be buried rapidly. They got to have a flood. That's the best way to bury and to create fossils is in a flood, which is precisely what the Bible tells us. Got a big flood. That's exactly what we see in the Grand Canyon. Big flood. That's exactly what we saw in the Tuttle River when Mount St. Helens blocked it up. We saw a big flood. We saw strata being laid down. We saw fossils being made. Do you know that in Spirit Lake today, fossils are being made? Right now, today, in front of our eyeballs. They've been buried in that ash up there at Mount St. Helens. So we're watching the fossilization from a catastrophe at Mount St. Helens right in front of our eyeballs. Now, that's what we can actually take into the laboratory. That's what we can photograph. That's what we can see here, taste, touch, and smell. And this evolution story here that we're supposed to be taught out of the fossil record is a fairy tale. A fairy tale that makes Santa Claus coming down a 6-inch pipe seem more rational, more logical. That's my point. Now, beginning at the base of the Cambrian period and extending for about 10 million years, all the major groups of skeletonized invertebrates made their first appearance in the most spectacular rise in diversity ever recorded on our planet. Snails, sponges, starfish, lobster-like animals called trilobites, and many other complex sea creatures appear suddenly. Interestingly, the same book observes some extinct trilobites, in fact, developed more complex and efficient eyes than any other living arthropod possesses today. My God, you've got some extinct trilobites that had more complex and efficient eyes than those that we see in existence today. Well, how the hell do you explain that? If the complex comes from the simple, how come you got the complex turning to the simple? That doesn't make any sense. That isn't even logical. That isn't even logical in evolutionary terms, for crying out loud. And yet that's what they keep printing in the textbooks, and that's what they keep telling us. That's why I keep telling you they keep lying. Politicians oftentimes lie when the truth would serve their purpose better. And these people, I don't even call them scientists. Now, scientists probably believe in evolution. I don't deny that. You know, people have beliefs. Hell, there are scientists that believe in Catholicism, for crying out loud. I don't think much of a Catholic scientist, but then, you know, there's some of those out there. The reason I don't think much of Catholic scientists over here was the Catholic Church, remember, told us that the world was flat and that the sun revolved around the earth. Hell, that wasn't science. That was propaganda. So, you know, when Galileo, who happened to be a scientist and happened to be a Catholic, you know, came along and he said, hey, I've got this telescope over here, and I'm observing, and here's what I'm observing. The Earth is revolving around the sun. The sun's kind of stationary there. And then the religious guys came along and said, you go out there and you start talking about that, and we're going to kill you. That's not science. That's propaganda. You know, science is where we take an honest look at something over here. Now, I'm not opposed to science. I'm just opposed to lies. And that's what I'm looking at here, and this book here exposes these lies. And it does it in layman's language. I mean, if you got a 12-year-old kid, you know, and you say, well, would you like to have a relatively simple book written by scientists? And by the way, in case you thought that all scientists believe in evolution, that's another fairy tale. Like Santa Claus coming down the chimney, that's a fairy tale. 44% of scientists tell you plainly they believe in creation. 56% of scientists say they believe in evolution. And the 56% of scientists who say they believe in evolution have to say that or they'll lose their jobs. The truth of the matter is, if you got right down on the bottom line and said, now, you're a scientist, we'd like to know what your honest-to-God belief is, evolution or creation, and you're not going to lose your job, I think that it would be down around 10%. 10% would tell you, I believe in evolution, and the other, if you have the 56% that claim that they believe in evolution, you'd lose about, you know, about 90% of those people. That's about what you'd lose. In fact, God himself said in the scripture, says, only the fool has said in his heart, in his mind, you know, in his inner being, only the fool has said in his heart there is no God. Then I don't think that most of you people out there are fools. I don't believe that. I had doubts about evolution. I believed in evolution. I thought maybe God had used evolution to create things. In fact, there's a lot of religious people, they believe in what we call the gap theory, that God used evolution over millions of years to create what you see out here. That's what we call Christian apologetics. They don't believe Genesis 1, 2, and 3. And they're making excuses for God. I don't think we need to make any excuses for this guy. You know, a guy that's able to make universes and galaxies and stars and planets and life and one thing and another, I don't think anybody needs to make excuses for the guy. He sounds like to me he can speak for himself. I think that this guy's probably, you know, he's older than the rest of us combined. He's been around for a long time. He says, I'm without beginning and I'm without end. And he says, I'm the same yesterday, today, and forever. And he says, I change not. Seems like to me that, you know, the story that he gave us here in Genesis 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Sounds like to me that he's able to communicate fairly logically, fairly intelligently. Now, there are some liars out there that come along, oh, no, this guy God, he's a liar. You know, he's not telling you the truth. And no, this isn't the way this happened. So, of course, then you and I have to come along. We have to sort through this and figure out, well, who's telling the truth over here? Well, so far, the evolutionists over here lied to us. I haven't seen a shred of truth in here at all. And the Jehovah's Witness, the witness group over here, or outfit called the Watchtower over here, they put out a book, 18,800,000 copies as of 1985. Assuming that they published a couple, three after that, they've got, you know, around 20 million of these books out here, written in layman's language. And this fossil record story in here, as I've just showed you over here, tells you very plainly from the scientists who wrote this, you know, the other group, the other team, they said, hey, this is crap. This evolution is just nonsense. And so that's why I took the time to show you here a couple, three arithmetic examples. You know, the sun is burning up at 5 feet an hour. Niagara Falls is wearing back at a certain rate. And we can go out there to the place where Niagara Falls started, and it fits right into 5,000 years. It wears back about 3 feet every year. We can just walk out there and take a look at where it started. And that's where it was falling over the cliff on day one. And it's been wearing back at 3 feet a year. And 5,000 years ago, that's where it is today. It's not a billion years old. Niagara Falls hasn't been running over that fall, you know, for billions of years. Hey, I'm out of time again, so I'm going to have to leave it right there. We'll take it up right here next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Let me remind you that you're listening to or have been listening to the Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. If you'd like one, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967 for yours. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. There, time's up. We're going to have to leave it right about here. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.